There's a phrase that sometimes comes up among those of us who love poetry. It's called the heresy of paraphrase. It's from a book published in 1947 by Clinnoth Brooks titled The Well-Wrought Urn, but it captures an idea that goes back to Aristotle. And this is the idea. A poem, at least a good poem, is a finely crafted work of art. And the way it's crafted, the way its words are structured, is intrinsic to its meaning. You can't paraphrase a poem. You can't say it really means or basically means this or that, like you can with other sorts of communication, without distorting it. Because how a poem uses language is as important as what its language conveys. In a poem, form and content are inseparable. This view of poetry is the reason those of us who love poetry end up running to our bookshelves in the middle of a dinner party and pulling down our favorite poems and reading them aloud to our unsuspecting guests. Because once you mention a poem you love, it doesn't only feel inaccurate to say it's about this or that, it feels like a kind of heresy, like your clumsy paraphrase is damaging it. And that's exactly how I feel about the poet I'm interviewing today. Leah Panea Wilson's new book is called I Built a Boat with All the Towels in Your Closet and Will Let You Drown. And if your ear or your mind popped a little when I said that title, that's because even her titles are poetry. Here's another one. She eats his heart. She has two hearts. She doesn't know which one to use. She begins to call the second heart Little Baby or Blitzkrieg. As you can hear, the sheer verbal energy, the grammatical verve and irreverent jolts of her language are dazzling, surprising, unparaphrasable, and if you happen to find yourself at my house for dinner, you'd be hearing me read it over more than one glass of wine. Fortunately, we have her here. Leah Panea Wilson, welcome to the New Books Network.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here. You're a poet.
Yes, most of the time. Sometimes I just live on the internet of Twitter, but yes, mostly poets.
Well, I am hoping at some point we can talk about your tweets, which are some of the most amazing things I have seen on Twitter. And I think that they're, if I were a literary scholar, I would want to write about that as well. but we have you here for a book today. It is entitled, I built a boat with all the towels in your closet and will let you drown. I mean, that is great.
Thank you.
And I think just the kind of energy in that title, it captures something about your sensibility, as a poet, something about, the kind of energy that your work has, which is tremendous. But I'm just kind of curious, right? So poets, they sort of come into the world in interesting and different ways than, say, you know, those of us that are stuck in the world of prose and argumentation or just everyday language. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, this is your first book, sort of the wellsprings of your own work and your sensibility?
Yeah. I actually, all my friends are prose writers, so for a really long time, I hated poetry. Because it's sort of staunchy and boring and really formal. But it turns out that poetry does not have to be really formal or boring. and so when I met the second generation New York school poets, not like met, but when I came in contact with, like Alice Notley, Anne Waldman, Eileen Miles, Barbara Guest, I didn't realize that language could let so much stuff in. Until then.
And that's what can you remember in reading their poetry? Like, was there what struck you? Like, when you say stuff, do you mean things besides angst and melancholy and blackbirds in a field all alone?
Yeah. I don't know if there are any blackbirds in the poets I mentioned. There's owls, but there's a lot of disembowelment. Stuff as in like everyday stuff, like this table that I'm sitting at or these bananas. Which are almost too ripe, or the pineapple that I'm staring at across the way. So there was less aestheticizing, I guess, everyday life, if you want to think of it like that, mm-hmm. And more sort of translating like what your actual lived experience is. And that's kind of how I think about poetry as an act of translation. So like, how can I translate whatever it is I'm dealing with out of my actual body so it can be on the page. And I think that that's a really hard thing to explain to people because it sounds very weird, right?
It does. Well, what I would expect traditionally would be something like a romantic capital R version of what's in my soul, right? Or an earlier version of what's in my mind. But to say body, what would that mean?
I don't know. It's hard. Like, if you notice my poems, they're sort of like irregularly rhymed and sometimes quite random. And there's a lot of interruptions in the poems and a lot of dialogue. And I think of those things as physical, like things language can do physically on the page. So it's like always moving around and never steal. Still, like be still, not steal as in I theft from you. But I think that is a thing that poetry is really good at. Sort of like the movement down and across and sideways on the page.
There is this tremendous kind of, I don't know what you call it, something like the energy of the page. I sometimes refer to it as the flip factor, like back when there used to be bookstores and you go in and you might be in the poetry section, which was usually in a dark corner by the restroom.
Yeah, but, you know, you'd it still is, I think.
I think it is. You'd open a book and you'd just be kind of like, I've seen this before. This just sort of looks drab. And then every once in a while you'd open one and you'd say, oh my goodness, I've never kind of seen poems laid out with that kind of energy. And, you know, you've got poems that work on both sides of the right and left margin. You've got ones that seem to trickle down the page, some very thin and kind of reminiscent of William Carlos Williams, and other ones that seem to be working in a kind of field aesthetic like Jory Graham or Charles Olson.
I love Jory Graham and William Carlos Williams and Charles Olson, actually. But I was going to say something about the way they move on the page. There's an interesting thing about like how time works in a poem differently than how, because you brought up fiction, differently than how it might work in fiction. Because a lot of the traditional fiction things, you have beginning, middle, end, and you have all this space to accomplish that in. And a poem has less space in that respect. Because you're reading on one page a lot of the times, and then you're turning the page, and the expectation is that you're going to get a new poem on that page. So I think that, like, this book in particular, now that I'm thinking about it, sort of illustrates the frustration with that reading, because some of the poems are broken up, and there's lots of references to poems that happened early in the book, later in the book.
And there's also sort of variations on earlier lines. So the title itself comes back, and, you know, the traditional poetic move is that this is the moment where a beacon goes off, and the title is a variation on the poem, or the poem is a variation on the title, but they aren't syncing.
Yeah. I think that there's so much that you can't control in the, like, kind of fucked up world that we live in, even before 2017, that it's okay I felt like I'm telling my students, it's okay if you can repeat yourself, just sort of like do it differently. Or if you keep coming back to, like, sometimes I come back to themes. I like animals, obviously. I write a lot of love poems, but they're never really the same, even though they're dealing with the same kind of themes.
Yes. And I think repetition is one of the ways you're getting music out of your poetry, the way it comes back. In fact, one ends, all wanting repetition. How do you execute a dash? So do you see it as musicality, or do you see it as sort of the condition of everyday life that you started off talking about?
I think both. If that makes sense. Do you ever have that weird feeling of like deja vu when you're doing something?
Oh, sure.
Yeah. So I guess I have that feeling often. And so sometimes I think that the poem reflects that feeling of, I've said this before, I've experienced this before, I've been here before. But I do read all the poems out loud on the point of musicality, to make sure that I can, to me, this is like really embarrassing, but to make sure that I can pronounce the words that I'm using in my poems. And to make sure that they sound okay, like in my mouth before I commit them to the page. Which I guess is a weird description now that I have said it out loud to you.
It is a weird description, but a very true one. And I think I will confess to have given readings and then gotten stumbled up in my own tangle of work. So I think I should do that. But there is this idea, you know, that I guess that the traditional term is diction, the kinds of words that show up that give a poem its feel. And your diction will go from sort of very simple, straightforward, sometimes even just nonsense syllables, to huge sort of conceptual, big polysyllabic Latinate terms.
I think that part of that, at least in this book, is that tension between the everyday life that I started talking about, and like how you would chat with your friends is not the same as how you might talk to a professor or how I might talk to you on this interview, which is apparently how I might talk to my friends. and I read a lot, and poets like evidence, or I guess I as a poet like evidence of my reading to be in my poems. So sometimes when that diction changes, it's like a response to things I'm reading. There's a poem in the book about birth, and that is when I was reading William Carlos Williams' Improvisions and Spring and All. So I was just sort of responding to the things I am reading. And because I have the attention span of a goldfish, I read a lot of different things at the same time. which is part of why the diction in the poems changed so much. And I get bored with my own voice, to be honest with you. So my poet voice on the page, not poet voice, often changes because I get bored of listening to myself sound the same. Because we don't often sound the same when we're talking. I don't know why I have to sound the same all the way through the book. And I think consistency is kind of overrated.
So I agree with you, and I think, but just to kind of throw it out there, right? Like the sort of one of the governing ways in which we've been talking about poetry really for the last 70 years is like voice, right? Like,
yeah.
I recognize the voice of such and such a poet. And here to suddenly be like, you know, I'm getting bored with my own voice. Yeah, find your voice. Discover your voice, you know.
Yeah, it's not such stupid advice. I hope no one's listening that has given that advice. because we have our own voices already. Like the way you talk, the way you punctuate your sentences, all those like sort of personal quirks. Like I'm moving my hands right now, and that's even part of my voice. So I think it's like stupid to tell like young, teaching a creative writing workshop this semester to find your voice, or they're like, I haven't found my voice yet. I'm like, you have, just own it a little more.
Great. Would you say that your aesthetic is one in which owning it just rung true to me, right? Something like, you're just a lot more comfortable in your skin, even when you're feeling uncomfortable in your skin, than I think a lot of poets.
Yeah, I think it's okay to be uncomfortable. I think maybe we're not uncomfortable enough, just in general. And I think it's okay to be anxious and terrified and scared. This is all things I feel whenever I'm in public. but I think that other people feel those things too. I don't know where I was going with that.
I think it's something about, you know, different kinds of ways that we think about poems. One is sort of capturing an emotion or something and just kind of putting the finger, I don't even know if I can put my finger on what exactly your poems are doing. I think one thing is that they don't want to settle in the sense of staying still or settling to be something like just one kind of poem or one kind of lyric moment or one kind of grasp at some sort of idea. They want to move.
Yeah, I think that because poetry is such a physical thing for me, even as I'm writing, I don't like to sit in one place. I like to move around. I like to sit outside. I like to randomly eavesdrop on people's conversations at places. And then when I get all this stuff on the page, I like to ask myself, how can the poem live on the page now? Like, now that I've put it out on the page, what help can I give it so that like it comes into itself?
And what lets you know you're on the right track as you're working through that process?
That's a great question. I guess I ask a lot of questions. So one of the other questions I ask at that point is, can it stay alive on its own? Does it need a title? Does it need another poem to sort of help it live in the world, I guess? Have I experienced some sort of fun by the end of the poem? I like things that are playful and fun and really random, like that goldfish moment I was talking about. So if it's accomplished something remotely like that, I feel good about it. And that's the thing. I don't think we always have to write amazing poems all the time. Not that my poems aren't amazing.
They are amazing.
Thank you. But I think that, like, to say that you're a poet sometimes becomes really intimidating. And, like, that's why a lot of my students are like, well, I'm not a poet, I'm a writer. And I'm like, okay, I'm a writer too. And I'm a poet. And there's this really long history of poetry being intimidating for all those things that you mentioned earlier, that I don't necessarily think is true.
It's traditionally the elevated art, right? The rarefied air. Please go ahead.
Oh no, sorry. Which is so interesting because, like, what Dante brought to the poem was autobiography, right? That moment when he looks back at Beatrice across that, whatever the river of forgetfulness is called. And so he's bringing autobiography into the poem, which feels like to me it should have uncanonized it in some way and made it less about a school of learning, but did not. So weird. Poetry's weird.
Poetry is very weird. It strikes me that another weird thing that you wouldn't hear many poets saying is, you know, sometimes a poem might need another poem, as though they aren't these autonomous individual art objects that are on a verbal pedestal. So when you think of this book, do you think of it as, I mean, how do you think of it as a collection of poetry? Is it an arc and an experience that a reader has from the beginning to the end, or do they dip into it? What's kind of the way you imagine your reader?
I think that this book in particular is an arc from the first poem or the first section to the last section. I think that you get a lot of information between the poems, and not that you can't dip into it, but you won't notice the changes in the words or the subject positions if you just sort of dip into it. Because one of the things that I wanted to do with this book was sort of investigate categories of girl, woman, other, lover, mother, like that kind of thing. And you can't do, I can't do that just by one single poem. So the book also works as sort of a series of corrections on itself.
When you say subject position, that's not coming out of the average everyday experience that you're having drinking with friends, or maybe it is, but that also sounds like professor speak a little bit.
It's Sunday, so I have workshop tomorrow. So half of me has professor speak brain, and then half of me is just like sitting drinking in my table, coffee, drinking coffee.
Okay, yes, it's too early or too late or something like that.
Well, it's 11:30 here, so I have like a half hour before I can like really commit to a cocktail, I feel like.
Okay, well, that sounds like a traditional poetic time. So when you have a title like She Adjusts Herself, Voice, Flesh, right? What does that cue us to hear or to listen for?
I bet you have heard women talk. And sometimes when they say things, they raise the end of their voice a little bit at the end of the sentence. I'm not doing a good job of it right now. And they sort of signal a question.
Yes.
even if it's something like my name is, your name is. So there's lots of little like vocal inflections I feel like that you learn as a woman or as a girl, a young girl, that might not be evident right off the bat, like the uncertainty of your own name.
Yes. Yeah.
And just like as a woman, you are really aware. I feel like I'm really aware. I won't speak for like all women, of how my body occupies space, which is a thing I think I have learned, not like born with, but
acculturated.
Like what have I accrued throughout the years of being in this identity category as woman, or being read as woman. And one of those things is things I do with my voice, that I might not have been aware of before, or how even I sit in a public space.
Well, so that's fascinating. And I'm curious, you know, you mentioned Dante and the kind of journey, that he takes, which should kind of be on one level is, you know, to let the self in, but it's also this journey through hell. And I'm getting the sense that you're seeing your book as a kind of journey through acculturated models of femininity. Now I sound too much like a professor, right? But variations on voice, things like that. So, so what do you imagine your reader experiencing from that first poem to that last poem? If they do see it as I am undergoing a journey on this boat built out of towels.
Yeah. I hope that they see some sort of friendship or community happening by the end of the book, that I feel like sometimes you don't have permission to do things until you see an example, or you're like, oh, it's okay to feel like this. I'm not alone in the world. I'm on this boat with this other bitch, and she will probably let me drown, or maybe not. So I guess I'm hoping they feel like they're not alone by the end of the book, and that it's okay to think that the world is fucked up, because it is. But you should still get on that boat.
I think it would be great if you'd be willing to pick a poem and let us hear a little bit of what that sounds like on the page or in your voice.
Yeah. I will read the description of some building first. Description of some building. They talked about never wanting to be in a long-distance relationship. Relationship. It's late autumn. Why is autumn always so late? She muses out loud about the condition of the world, the weather, it's different here. I'm cold. She named her desire, she named hers. What did you invite in? She's baffled at herself. At her impasse, Mexican standoff, momentarily romantic shit. The human impulse to expose. I fell outside, dropping off my rent check, scraping my knees, there was blood. Never wanting to be the subject, never wanting you. You cannot break. It's yours. Yours. My heart is yours. That's that poem.
Well, that poem is not only beautiful as a love poem, but I wonder if you could share with the people who are listening what that looks like on the page.
Yeah. The poem has several quotation marks around different phrases of it on the page. And so the poem, it interrupts itself. I really love Alice Notley. So the impetus for trying that in my poems came from reading The Descent of Alette. And I think that there's something about always continually being interrupted in who you are, that's very real. So I like it. I like the poem to reflect those kind of interruptions, if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense.
And I also imagine that, like, if I'm reading this poem, what I would have is one voice for every quotation mark, so that the poem would be multi-voiced. So it'd have all these voices making the same sort of sentence, phrase, experience out loud.
And would you imagine that sort of each chunk of language would be a different person or variations?
Yeah, different. No, I'd imagine it to be a different person. So like by the end of this poem, if I had 30 more friends, you would have heard it in 30 more voices, but like sort of all being this chorus.
So, how I imagine. So then is it a love poem? You know, with the traditional sort of I and thou, I and you?
Oh, I don't think it's a love poem in that way. I do think there are a lot of love poems in this book. I think often when someone asks me, what is your work about? I tell them I'm really interested in the romantic other, but I don't necessarily think that that has to be a lover. I think it could be a sister or a brother or a friend. And I think that we all experience those moments where we feel like we're in love and we are, and then we're not. And then sort of how painful it is to be like weirdly ripped away from one womb into another. That is a strange metaphor that I made, but I am going to commit to it.
I think that's the best thing to do. Well, so let me ask you yet another terrible question that writers get, right? The one is, what's your work about? Right, where you have to give some reductive answer about the nature of your work. Another one, though, is, right, even worse, like, so what is your work doing that we haven't seen? What's new? When you look at this book, what do you see in terms of kind of, you know, how it's pushing what American poetry is doing right now?
I've been thinking a little about that, a little, because I had just finished revisiting H.D.'s Helen in Egypt, which is a beautiful book, and I recommend it to everyone. But Helen in Egypt is very pretty. And I don't mean that reductively, but I mean the kinds of, and it's sort of a long love poem among other things, but I mean her ideas about relationships and lines are just pretty. You read it and you're like, yes, yes, these flowers are beautiful. But I think that something my book is in conversation with is how sort of gross love is, and how like sort of ugly and anxious that it is. And you question like yourself, I think a lot. I question myself, I think a lot. I won't talk for everyone. And it's weird to think about how you are in a relationship with someone and how that's physical, right? It's like, what does my body mean now that we are in conversation with each other in this way? And I just think that's like sometimes really disgusting.
So if for HD, a reading of her poem would be someone saying yes, 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 would a successful reading of your poem being having a reader say gross, gross, gross?
I hope so. Or like, yeah, that is what it feels like. It's not, love is like, it's, I don't know, no emotion really is like really consistent. Do you know what I mean? It's not like I am in this euphoric position all the time. There's a lot of work that goes into romantic relationships, into like other kinds of relationships. And I think that my book was the process of that work. If I can like talk professor speak for a second.
Yeah.
And I think that that is important. And also, I think it's also goes into, and I'll just like meta, the work that goes into poetry at all, like into building a book of poems. And sometimes they're just like ugly things that happen. And I think we should talk about those. Maybe. Does that answer your question? I'm just like kind of rambling.
It does answer my question. I think, Edgar Allan Poe has that essay, The Philosophy of Composition, where he explains how he composed The Raven because it was such a success. And it's a complete lie. It's, you know, he basically goes about detailing his mathematical process of how he did the entire thing in his head before he put one word onto paper. And then at one little point, he kind of says, as a wink to let you in on this sophisticated joke, that he says a writer would be, you know, nothing of this is like what goes on behind the scenes the moment before the curtain goes up with chicken feathers and blood and everybody rushing around and, you know, things falling. And you know right then, if you've ever written that's the wink, and this whole thing is a big joke on the public, that it's a flawless, bloodless, sublime process.
Yeah, it makes it like untouchable in a way. And like, I want the chicken feathers and the blood to be in the poem. To be a part of that experience, so you don't feel excluded from the making of the poem. Denise Levertov, has that last line in a poem I really love, and she's just like describing this relationship, and she says it throbs in the teeth. And that's kind of, that's like one of the things I use to measure if my poem is like done, I'm air quoting right now. Does it throb in the teeth? Like that sort of nails on the chalkboard thing,
mm-hmm.
when like you're like, you're done with the nails on the chalkboard, and, but it also feels really bodily and comfortable.
Is there a poem in the collection where you think like this is sort of one of my touchstones for that? Like here, I knew I hit it.
There's a couple poems in the collection that do a similar thing, and they also sort of invite silliness in, because I like to interrupt myself. It's sort of how I think. It's how I talk, obviously. so like something, the poem will feel really clean for a second, and then there's just random stuff that happens, and you're like, this doesn't quite make sense. Is this really even a poem? And so there are a couple of poems like that in the collection, if that's sort of what you mean. And there are a couple like really clean poems too.
I would love to hear one of the messy ones.
Okay. How about the History of the Erratic? Again, that one's kind of messy. And so is, okay, I'll read the History of the Erratic.
That
first.
Sounds great.
Okay. Everyone has a secret. Hers inside hers. It's eating her from the inside. That savage assailant, it chews on our lungs, makes breathing difficult. Exercise, no. The equation, she can't find the equation. She tries to scare it out. Everything fears. Applies all the tactics of old. She hits herself in the face. Throws her body into a lake, hot rock. Slams her hand to the refrigerator door. She's in pain. Her hand is cold. She eats a taco, some fried rice, a bowl of banana Foster ice cream. She tries to vomit, fails, laughs at the irony. She eats the same things again, 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 but this time she tops them all off with ranch dressing and a few glasses of cheap wine. She vomits, searches her vomit for some secret, any secret, something warm, something real, really real, authentic. Damn, fuck. She's not sure how many days left before complete digestion. She's digesting herself. She falls onto the bed to ponder the statistical likelihood of that. The authenticity escapes her. Now she shines. Now she's sullen, and she doesn't know what to do with herself. She's a little erratic. She refuses to look at herself, refuses the look of it. That's the end of the poem.
Yeah, yeah. So once again, that's another poem in which every single line is sort of, or it's collected in terms of quotations, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. A lot of those poems are like, there's a she and her in the poem. And so at moments where I felt like this was a feeling that my other lady friends have told me they've had, or my sisters. And so I put a lot of those poems in quotations, because I felt like they spoke to something maybe a little more universal than some of the other ones.
So that's fascinating. So what do you do with the kind of commonplace that, you know, what makes a poem is lines?
Oh, yeah.
Right? What makes a poem? That's how you know.
Yeah, it's a line. No, I think that that is a, and I hope none of my poetry teachers are listening, I think that's a misrepresentation. I think what makes a poem is breath. It's like when you breathe, like I'm just breathing deeply, for example, but like you can't see that. It's like at the end of a phrase, when you breathe in, I think that's what makes a poem. And often poets break their lines when they breathe. It's like a poet trick. Everyone talks about it, but no one really believes it. But it's actually true. And so as long as you're reading the poem out loud, really anything can be a line.
Yeah, I think it's the poet Stanley Plumlee used to throw this sort of gauntlet of like, I defy anyone to know where the line breaks are in a free verse poem when they're read out loud, because it'll look different on the page because they breathe differently.
Yeah. Well, it's also like, it's also the amount that sometimes in a line, you're like, I can't hold all those words in my mouth in the same breath. So often I'll break a line there, which is what's great about the quotation marks. And I also like slashes and dashes, because they give me a second, to breathe as I'm reading the poem. And maybe the reader a second, to breathe with me as they're reading the poem.
So you say there are moments of breath. I know that you know, for Dickinson, the dash is often a moment of, or a flight of thought. You have the use of quotation marks and slashes that, you know, traditionally denote poetic lines in prose.
Sometimes things just look better in paragraphs, though. it looks nicer, and some things look nicer in a paragraph than they do in a line.
Yeah, so you're doing this PhD thing, and you're citing Dante, and you're citing HD, and schools of poetry and things. When you write, do you feel like this kind of scholarly historical poetry self is at the table, or is that a kind of different gear?
I think that I have learned a lot from that scholarly group of poets that I have been studying. I guess I would say they are at the table. I mean, I consider them company, even if what I'm doing is sort of like raging against what they're talking about, or just kind of nodding to them, like, thank you for giving me permission to do this. I am going to do this other thing. You're dead, so I guess it doesn't really matter if you like it or not. Such a mean-spirited response to your own company.
They'll get over it. They'll get over it, you know?
I hope so. I feel like if I believed in, like, hell, I just, like wrote myself a ticket. talking back. But, like, I do think that that I often write in conversation with other poems that I'm reading. So sometimes, like, there's a Charles Williams poem in the book, and I use improvisions, which is a word he uses in the poem. So sometimes their bones will be in the poems in that way.
I think that the way in which, you know, artists reinvent their predecessors is one of the greatest tributes to their predecessors. And of course, it's as you say, it's never in the way that predecessor would have said. But that's what makes it great. There was this sad essay in William Gass's last collection where he was talking about whether or not he would have the kind of influence on future fiction writers that, you know, the people he'd wrote about had. And he was like, nobody took us up. Nobody's really interested in doing the huge, long, modernist tome, 800-page tome. You know, David Foster Wallace died, but everybody... magical realism and, you know, Junot Diaz, and that's where the excitement and the energy is. So I don't know if you want disciples so much as people at the table who love your work.
That sounds better than disciples. It feels like you could do a better job of, like, eating or whatever. Yes. Like sharing.
Who wants to kneel on wood? I don't.
It sounds uncomfortable.
So we've had a chance to talk a little bit about how you kind of locate your sensibility and your poetry in terms of the tradition. I'm also curious as to how you think about it in terms of, you know, our cultural moment. And I'm just going to say again, you have one of the most linguistically energetic Twitter feeds I have ever seen. It's hilarious and full of dark pathos, and, you know, sometimes you imagine, like, what time did that get posted? It's just great. So you do seem to be a writer who has not only different registers within her poetry, but different linguistic registers outside of it. And I'm kind of curious as to, you know, are you one of those that feels like you're responding to the culture as much as the tradition, to, you know, when that average everydayness hits you, how does that feel?
Yeah. Charles Williams has that quote that I guess everyone quotes, but we were talking about him, that the poem is a large or small machine made up of words. And that's how I think of my Twitter. It's like a large machine made up of a lot of small words. And sometimes I do respond to cultural moments on my Twitter. But like I said earlier, I have the attention span of a goldfish. So I Twitter randomly. But that's one of the things I really like about the internet, like Twitter or Instagram is what I use mostly, about the way that it's like continually ripping you. This is like both great and bad. Ripping you away from the world, like from the real things that are happening, and at the same time throwing them in right up in your face. Because it's hard to escape all the things happening in the world on the internet now, when so much of it is about about like sort of that those public moments of witness, right?
Yeah. And do you see a kind of do you see any stylistic affinities between the tweet and the poem?
I mean, not in this book, but a tweet makes you think of a line. It's like limited by characters on the internet. And what I was saying about breadth, I think is really true on the Twitter, because your line can't be so long, or you can't tweet it, or you have to break it up into tweets. I think Twitter is doing a little more maybe for like the essay than it's doing for poetry. But I don't know. Just in that the essay is really good at sort of like investigating something and redefining it over again and being in conversation with all these multiple things at one time. And to me, that feels very much like the pathos that is in Twitter, or like the sort of conceit that Twitter is working with. A little more than a poem.
So as of last night, you have been terrorizing a drink company that does Caribbean flavors. KA Drinks has never been so interestingly treated as you have tweeted. So tell me how it works out in that example.
Kathy Acker.
Is that what that is?
Yeah, that's Kathy Acker. I'm
Oh, that is not KA Drinks.
No, if Kathy Acker had a Twitter and she drank. I don't know if she drank. I bet she did. No, wait, no. I don't know if she did or not.
Oh, okay. See, this might be the vagaries of Twitter, because hashtag KA takes you to KA Drinks, which is
God, does it?
Caribbean right flavors now. Done wonderfully, and so I didn't know if it was you just suddenly That's finding so- a drink of choice and then deciding that they would become your cause. But no, no, Kathy Acker makes more sense.
No, I feel like I can't really commit to one drink of choice. I guess I'm kind of flaky in that way. I'm just like, it sort of depends on what the weather is like, what mood I'm in, what alcohol is in the pantry. No, I'm rereading Pussy King of Pirates for this other thing that I'm working on. So those are Kathy Acker.
Okay, all right. So yes, and she's known to have quite a verbal texture.
Yeah, definitely. And I guess I'm kind of interested in like sort of the history of the of madness and of the erratic, and how those things sort of intersect with these other like women, like what does this mean for a woman? And I think the history, I feel like it would be different for, I don't know what I'm trying to say.
Well, it's a very different tradition from the kind of HD, right?
Yeah.
Outsider art, counterculture, William Burroughs.
Yeah, differently institutionalized, I think is what I'm trying to say.
Okay.
And so that's the new thing I'm working on. So I was just refreshing, like putting Kathy Acker back in the company. now that I've had HD at my table for so long, it's like HD went away on a vacation, and now I invite Kathy Acker back because I don't know if they would be friends.
At least you have someone that will carve into the table now.
Yeah.
Well, can you tell us a little bit about what you are working on? You know, this book is out, and I hope it is finding lots of readers, and you know, but I'm sure you're moving forward with your own work.
Yeah. I am working on a new thing that started out sort of ephrastically, responding to that portrait, Christina's World, that has the lady sitting in the field.
Sure, that famous, is it Wyatt?
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, like the one sort of everyone knows.
Mm-hmm.
And the poems are turning out a little meaner than I had first intended them to be, but we do live in a very mean time. So there are a bunch of short poems, like mostly short poems that are in response to the meanness, I guess, of our current,
so what,
world on fire.
Sure. So if we think about kind of the world on fire and, you know, the rise of Trumpism and the media swirl around that, you know, this iconic image of the woman, Christina, lying in the grass with the kind of gold grass, and off in the distance, there's the farmhouse.
Yeah, and her hands are like sort of differently colored in that portrait too. She's like almost digging into the earth.
So, I think, wasn't she crippled?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think she, and so, yep. So how does that become a focal point for you for talking about the present? It seems very kind of pastoral, maybe in a creepy way.
Oh, I didn't think about it like that. I'm going to write that down and think about the pastoral in a creepy way a little more. But I think that the idea that she's staring off into the distance and she's stuck in that one spot, and she has been crippled, and we don't know by what, even though in this current politicalness, we understand that we are being crippled by all the Trump stuff. Right. And his sort of cabinet of super real Nazis. And so I'm just thinking about that historic, I guess, as this historic moment with her. I haven't gotten very far on this project. And I just sat another project aside that was sort of a response to HD and all the epics I've been reading. To start this new thing, which is definitely totally different.
Well, I love the idea of you calling it super real as some sort of alternative to surreal, because it does. It just feels yeah. just so super real.
Yeah, it does.
In the
it
worst does. Way.
Like, it does. Like, to call it surreal, I think at first I felt like the rise of Trumpism or whatever was surreal. It's like, can this really be happening? And it is. So now it's super real. It's like, it does have an effect on your body. So like part of the project is about the effect that the kind of language and all these other body things have on particular bodies.
Yeah. Well, it sounds fascinating.
I hope so. I'm not very far in it. So like, I can't really tell you a lot. I would if I could.
Well, I hope that once it finds its whatever final form it has, and since you put things like final and done in quotes, I'll do the same thing. But you'll come back and talk to us about it.
Yeah. I guess I only put them in quotes because I feel like everything I write is still in conversation with the thing that came before it. I'm just like writing one long poem. It's not true, but it's like how I think of it sometimes.
It feels like it. It feels like we lay each poem as a step we kind of put down, and then you can step on that and figure out where you're going to go next.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, what is your citizenship now? It's so funny.
Well, Leah, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for letting me interrupt myself a million times and you.
Well, the book is called I Built a Boat with All the Towels in Your Closet and Will Let You Drown. Wonderful. Thank you again.
Thank you.
My name is Eric LeMay, and you've been listening to an interview with Leah Panea Wilson, author of I Built a Boat with All the Towels in Your Closet and Will Let You Drown, on the New Books Network.